You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Simon Botts returns to the show this week. A few years ago, he published For the Thrill of It, Leopold Loeb and the Murder That Shocked Chicago. This was the first book to fully examine the famous case of the privileged teenagers who kidnapped and murdered a boy, and the subsequent trial in which Clarence Darrow, the noted attorney for the damned, fought to save Leopold and Loeb from the death penalty. Simon Botts' new book, The Girl on the Velvet Swing, Sex, Murder, and Madness at the Dawn of the 20th Century, takes a look at another famous crime in the early 20th century, the murder of architect Stanford White by Harry Thaw, and the young woman in the center of the story, Evelyn Nesbitt. Simon Botts, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Well, I want to thank you, Gary, for having me back on your show, and it was good to talk to you about the other book, and now I'm looking forward to talking about Stanford White and his affairs in New York City.
Well, it turns out there were a lot of crimes of the century, although this was one of the first, since it was 1901. And if people remember the case at all, it's either from E.L. Doctorow's novel Ragtime, which was also a movie in which Elizabeth McGovern played Evelyn Nesbitt, or the film The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing from 1955, in which Joan Collins played Evelyn. Well, was there much fact in either of those versions?
Well, you know, I'm most familiar with the second film, and what interested me about that, about seeing that film, about a year and a half ago, because Evelyn was a consultant on that film in 1955, and she was paid $30,000. And I was fascinated by it because it gave a very benign, charitable portrayal of Stanford White. And so I always wondered, well, was this Evelyn changing her mind as she comes towards the end of her life? And was she telling the film producers that this was the real portrait she wanted to have of the architect? Because there's a lot of what I discovered when I started writing the book and doing the research was that actually there's a lot more ambiguity in the case than you might first think. There's been a lot of books written on this case. One came out a decade or so ago, but all of these previous books have simply described the facts of the murder, and they haven't really gone much further than that. They haven't taken the story to the first trial of the murderer, Harry Thaw, and so I went into that detail in my book. But what I can do is start off, I think, by telling you about the event as it happened, the murder of Stanford White, and then we can get into all the details later.
Please do.
Okay, great. So Stanford White was really a celebrity at the beginning of the 20th century. He had been really responsible for some marvelous buildings, most of which have been torn down in the destruction, in the rush to the future. But I think his most beautiful building was the second Madison Square Garden. There have been four buildings, four Madison Square Gardens in the history of New York, and Stanford White's was actually on Madison Square at 26th Street. And this was an incredible building, very beautifully done in the style of the Italian Renaissance. It was originally designed for horse shows, and it had a tower, seven-story tower with apartments on each floor. And Stanford White was known around town. Everybody knew Stanford White, and Stanford White knew everybody else. And he was closely connected with the theater. He was a member of the Players Club. And he met a young girl called Evelyn Nesbitt, who was 16 years old. He was 47. And one evening, when Evelyn's mother was away in Pittsburgh, and the mother asked Stanford White to look after her daughter, and they had a sort of friendship, and then Stanford White invited Evelyn to his townhouse one evening in 1901. And when Evelyn, this was ostensibly for a party, and when Evelyn arrived there, she found herself alone with Stanford White. According to her testimony, he drugged her, and then she lost consciousness, and she woke up in bed, naked in bed, with White next to her, and she realized that he had raped her while she had been unconscious. So that's really the first kind of act in this story, the first dramatic event.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a young girl with no resources would have, in those days, would have disappeared into oblivion, because White had was a very powerful and influential man. But what happened, in fact, was that Evelyn married Harry Thor, whose family was worth $40 million in 1901 dollars. So that's about $500 million in our money.
And it was a Pittsburgh steel family, was it?
Actually, it was a Pittsburgh coal family, because they owned tens of thousands of acres of western Pennsylvania. And coal was discovered in their land. And, of course, coal was the fuel for the Industrial Revolution, which took place to a large part in the kind of western Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh area. The steel industry was there. And also Thor's father was a major shareholder in the Pennsylvania Railroad. So those were two enormous industries at that time, and the family had already made a huge amount of money. And Harry Thor himself was getting an allowance of $80,000 a year, which is probably about $1 million in our money. And there are no taxes at that time as well, of course. So that's a lot of money for a young man. And Evelyn was married to Harry Thor eventually in 1905. And then she told her husband about the rape. And New York was a much smaller place in those days, mostly because, first of all, people didn't really travel much. You didn't go on vacations to Europe very easily. And the second thing is that you really didn't go north. If you were a middle class or well off, you wouldn't go north of perhaps 59th Street, and you wouldn't go south of 14th Street unless you had an office on Wall Street. And you wouldn't go to the east or the west side, because those were very dangerous areas of the city. So the reason I say that is because Harry Thor and Stanford White and Evelyn Nesbit were always bumping into each other. And Harry Thor became gradually obsessed with the thought that this architect had raped his wife. Never mind that it was a couple of years before he had even met Evelyn, but this was his obsession. So, and then one evening, by chance, all three of them were at the theater, and this was at the same theater in Madison Square Garden, in the building that White had designed. And Stanford White was sitting at the front. Thor and his wife were sitting towards the back. And Harry Thor and Evelyn decided to leave early. And as Evelyn was getting into the elevator, Harry started walking towards Stanford White. He faced White, pulled out his gun, and shot the architect three times. And White died instantly. So that's the main event.
Right. And your book goes into a lot of detail about the trial, and I want to get to that too. But before we do, let me ask you some questions.
Yeah.
So I guess it's interesting. I mean, your book has a very contemporary feel, because all of these things seem to be happening in the news right now. But
right.
Do you think that the rape actually occurred?
Well, you've asked a really central question. And just to talk a little bit about the time in which the book was published, to be quite honest, I was astonished, because it seemed like every day, and we're talking about December, January, February, a few months ago, and it seemed like every day some famous man was being exposed as a predator who had done this, that, and the other. And at the same time, my book was being published, which was really 120 years ago, the same thing was going on.
You planned it, right? You planned the release of your book to coincide with the
1990s. I wish. Well, it was an extraordinary coincidence. So, your question was, did the rape actually occur? So here's what happened. Here's the situation: that Harry Thor has killed White in front of hundreds of witnesses. And this is the sensation of the day because it has all the elements you can imagine. I mean, it has the celebrity of Stanford Waite. It has the wealth of Harry Thor. It has the sexual tension of Evelyn and the dynamic of the other two men. And it's a New York City story and all the New York newspapers. And there were 14 newspapers at the time. And they're all involved in this Darwinian struggle for survival. And they all fasten on this case as a way to sell copies of the newspapers, obviously. And so it's just extraordinary coverage. I mean, just pages and pages of newspaper coverage on this case. And but Thor has been arrested. He's charged with first-degree murder. And the district attorney, Travis Jerome, wants the death penalty. He wants to send Thor to the electric chair. And so what defense can you possibly mount? And the attorneys that Thor had hired said, well, your only chance is insanity. Plead insanity. You'll spend a few years in the asylum, and then when the fuss has died down, you'll be released. But Thor said, there's just no way I'm doing that. I'm not. First of all, I'm not insane. Second, I did the world a service because I killed this rapist who defiled my wife. And then the third thing was the public opinion was like 95% behind Thor. Every day he was in the Tombs prison, which is the city prison in New York, or was, and sackfuls of mail are arriving every day congratulating him on having killed a rapist and a pedophile. And the penalty, when Stanford Waite raped Evelyn, the penalty was very severe. It was actually 20 years in the penitentiary. And in those days, prison conditions were very brutal. And it's very doubtful that Stanford Waite would have survived a sentence that long.
So if Evelyn Nesbitt had charged him with rape when she was 16...
Exactly, exactly, which almost certainly would never have happened, and she would have just disappeared, and he would have gone and continued his life. So the question was, so Harry Thor is saying we want to say this is justifiable homicide, and that's going to be the defense. But the question is, how are you going to say you're going to? That depends on you saying that Evelyn was raped. But there's only one witness to that, obviously. There's no corroborating evidence. And the rape happened 5 years before. And the district attorney was extremely experienced, extremely clever. And so everybody thought that there was just no way that Evelyn, who was 21 years old at the time, was going to be able to withstand cross-examination. She did well in terms of giving her testimony, but then the district attorney revealed some details that began to cast doubt on her account. And one was that she had continued her relationship in some form of relationship with Waite after the rape. But the most damning thing was that Evelyn, the district attorney, was able to pinpoint the date when it allegedly occurred from the testimony that Evelyn gave, and he wanted to introduce into the court evidence that would show that Waite was with friends somewhere else in the city. He couldn't introduce that evidence because nothing about that had been introduced in direct examination. And one of the rules of the court was that you couldn't cross-examine if there had been nothing in the direct examination. But it kind of lingered like a question mark over the whole thing. And what was also curious was that Evelyn refused to say when the rape had occurred. The district attorney said, well, was it October? Was it September? Was it November? And she said, no, I can't remember the month. Then he asked, well, what was the weather like?
That sounds very familiar from recent news coverage also, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. But then he asked, well, what was the weather like? Was it cold? Was it raining? Was the sunshine out? She couldn't remember. Now, here's my position as an author, right? I simply want to present the whatever account is out there. I don't have a particular agenda to support Waite, or to support the district attorney, or to support Evelyn. And so what I tried to do in the book was really hold back from giving any kind of statement that it happened or it didn't happen. because there's really arguments on both sides. I mean, one of the arguments for saying that it certainly did happen was that there was a second trial. In the first trial, there was a hung jury. And in the second trial, Evelyn comes again into court, and she repeats her testimony, and she manages to get it exactly the same. Okay, and the two trials are separated by a year. So the first trial happens in 1907, and the second in 1908. And that's a very difficult thing to do if you're lying, okay? If you're telling the truth, it's very easy to repeat the same account exactly the same. But if you're lying, it's almost impossible, because how can you remember from 1 year what you said the previous year? So there's very strong evidence that, in fact, she was telling the truth about the rape. And in the second trial, the jury again regarded her as a credible witness. And they also believed the attorneys that in the second trial, the defense was that, in fact, Thor was insane. And that was the decision. The jury found him not guilty by reason of insanity, and the judge committed him to the state asylum in Matawan, which is upstate New York.
And people would think, oh, that's the end of the story, but of course it's not. But before we get to what happens next, I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with Simon Botts. His new book is called The Girl on the Velvet Swing, Sex, Murder, and Madness at the Dawn of the 20th Century. He's also the author of For the Thrill of It, Leopold Loeb and the Murder That Shocked Chicago. So there's definitely a possibility then that Thaw simply hated Stanford White for whatever reasons he hated him and wanted to kill him and used poor Evelyn Nesbit as an excuse for what he did. But that brings the question of what would make a woman say that she'd been raped in 1907 as opposed to now when she hadn't been, because it's not going to reflect well on her.
Well, here's what I think might have happened, and again, it's really speculation because there's no way of telling one way or the other. But remember that Evelyn and Harry are married, man and wife. Evelyn is only 21. I mean, that's a very young age. What's possible is that the lawyers, the defense lawyers who were being paid a lot of money, fabricated this defense, fabricated the rape, and then put a huge amount of pressure on Evelyn to testify falsely. I know when I was 21, I did things that were not right or that I would withdraw now. And I think it's perhaps difficult when you reach middle age to realize how naive or impressionable a 21-year-old can be. And it's certainly feasible that that might have occurred, that simply all of these men putting pressure on her, save your husband from the electric chair. And also, she does have a... you know, she's married to this man, so she would presumably want to save his life, and if this is offered out to her as a way to do that. But again, of course, it's a serious matter to perjure yourself in court. And so, but there's really no way of telling.
Also, she's an actress, so therefore her ability to recall lines exactly might have something to do with that.
Yes, that's certainly possible. She was actually more of a chorus girl than an actress, but and she wasn't, she wasn't very good, from what I can gather. Her acting career kind of fizzled out very quickly.
She did make at least one movie, didn't she?
Oh, she actually made several. And again, her career afterwards is very interesting, because she herself, after the second trial and after Harry Thaw was sent to the asylum, she was a celebrity. I mean, simply because of her association with this case and because of her testimony. I mean, this was sensational stuff back in 1907.
She was one of the first women to be famous because she was famous.
I think you can. There's a good case to make that argument. But the thing is that she then went into vaudeville. I mean, she had no resources. Harry Thaw and Evelyn kind of went. They really had a falling out very quickly because he wanted her to move near the asylum in this small village upstate. She refused to do that because there was nothing for her to do there, and, you know, she didn't like to go to the asylum. It wasn't a very pleasant place. And so they had a falling out, and she went into vaudeville. They got divorced in 1915, and then she, at the second half of the 19-teens, went into the silent movies, and she made probably maybe 8 or 9 movies, silent movies. Most of them, I think, have disappeared and are no longer exist, as many of those first movies have been destroyed. Then, in around 1919, she became addicted to morphine and to cocaine. And that was about 3 years, and she made a lot of money making these silent movies, astonishing amount of money, but she lost it all because of her drug habit. But fortunately, she was able to break the habit around 1922, and then she had a career as a cabaret singer in Atlantic City and New York City.
But of course, Harry K. Thaw must have been so grateful to her that he took care of her for the rest of her life in a high style.
Well, your question tells me that you know what happened. So she had a son. Evelyn had a son, Russell, and I think the birth was 1913. I'm not sure I can check that date exactly. And she always claimed that her son was Harry Thaw's son. But in fact, that couldn't have been the case. I think the father was someone called Jack Francis, who was a newspaper reporter. Evelyn, of course, wanted to claim that Harry was the father because that would presumably give her a legitimate claim on the family fortune. But that never happened. And her son, Russell, became a test pilot, moved to California with his wife and 3 children. And Evelyn, in the 1930s, moved to California to be with her grandchildren and lived out her life, and I think died in 1967. And the only thing that happened in the meantime was this this consultancy work for the film that was in 1955.
Joan Collins kind of looks a little like her.
Well, Joan Collins was certainly a very attractive woman. I mean, when I was growing up, she was, I think, called the sexiest woman in the world. So, but she played the part very convincingly, and it is quite a good film. I mean, it doesn't have much depth, but it certainly gives, I think that film gives a very good portrayal of the case and is very good in that sense.
So the insanity plea aspect in terms of Thaw, he thought he would just be incarcerated briefly. To what degree had the insanity plea been used before?
It had been customary in the American courtroom since at least the 1880s. The test of insanity is the same test that was used in Britain. It's called the McNaughton rule, and the test of insanity is, is someone able to distinguish between right and wrong? Does someone know that the act that he or she did is wrong? And on that basis, what happened in the second trial was that a lot of psychiatrists came in to testify about Thaw, and also people from his childhood, teachers, came to talk about Thaw. And, you know, the portrait they all portrayed was damning. But, of course, Harry Thaw himself said, "No, I'm not insane. This is just something I'm doing, and I expect to get out." And he, almost as soon as he stepped into the asylum, his lawyers were petitioning to get him out of the asylum through habeas corpus proceedings. In other words, what would happen is that the asylum authorities would be brought into court, and they would have to show why they were keeping Harry Thaw in custody. Now, he always got a hearing, but he never got the decision he wanted. So what happened was he remained in the asylum until 1913. He was stuck in the asylum. He had the newspapers. He was getting the daily newspapers, and he was reading about Evelyn. And she was going out on the town, according to the newspapers, with these young men. So he gradually became furious with this situation. He was stuck unfairly, so he thought, in the asylum, and his wife is out on the town. So in 1913, he decided that there was no other way that he could get out except by escaping. And so one morning, the milk was being delivered. That gate was open. He slipped out, and there was a limousine waiting for him. And he roared off in the car to Canada. Canada wanted nothing to do with him, and they threw him back across the border. This is in a very remote part, by the way, of the northeastern United States. And so he was eventually extradited back to New York City. This is all in 1915. The thing about an extradition, though, between one state and another state is that you always have to have an indictment. You can't just extradite someone on a whim. You can't just say to New Hampshire, send so-and-so to New York. So New York had to present an indictment against Dorr, and the indictment they came up with was conspiracy to escape from the asylum. And they had a paradox there, because if Thor is insane, how can he conspire? It doesn't make any sense. And the jury at the trial decided, in fact, that Thor was not guilty, and also decided that he was sane. And so he got his freedom in 1915, and he went off and lived his life after 1915.
So even though he cold-bloodedly murdered a guy, he got away with it.
Well, he spent... 13, he spent about 5 years in the asylum, but otherwise, yes, he got away with it. And of course, the district attorney was motivated, Travis Jerome was motivated to give him the electric chair because Thor seemed to be exactly the kind of millionaire who was flaunting his money and evading justice through his fortune, through his millions of dollars that the family had.
Which is very similar to the case that you wrote about a few years ago when you wrote for The Thrill of It, the Leopold and Loeb case, because they came from rich families. And one of the arguments was, you know, if they had been from poor families, they would have been executed instantly.
Yes. Oh, they wouldn't have had such a incredible defense that Clarence Darrow gave them. So, the other interesting thing about this case, about the Stanford White case, of course, is something that kind of began to annoy me a little bit, and that was the constant references to it, to the rape as a seduction. Okay, and this kind of puzzled me because every single account I've come across before my book has referred to this as a seduction, and it's obviously not a seduction if you drug someone.
It's a Bill Cosby seduction.
Yes, and you know, we don't talk about such things this way, and so I began to think about this, and I think what happened is that in the 1950s, because when it happened, public opinion was overwhelmingly behind Thor. But in the 1950s, people, historians and writers, began to look at Stanford White as an architect, and they attempted to, you know, say, here is this wonderful architect who changed New York City, but they had the problem of the rape, and one way to avoid that problem is to describe the rape as a seduction. Okay, and so it's that rehabilitation of Stanford White's reputation. And what I did in my book is the word seduction never appears. I describe it the way it is, and not to give it a false aspect.
Yeah, and that's one of the, I guess that's one of the things that rings into current events. I mean, many of the people who have been accused of doing terrible things are people that we have admired for years and whose work we love. I had a guest on my show here not long ago, Tippi Hedren, the actress who starred in The Birds with Alfred Hitchcock, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. And, she, you know, he absolutely attempted to rape her, and then he used his power to destroy her career. And, of course, he's a guy we admire. We love his work. We love his films. But he was a repugnant person that did terrible things. So that was what was happening with Stanford White. People admired his work and didn't want to face the truth of what kind of person he might have been.
And I think that's exactly right. And I think one of the things that's noticeable about all the recent cases that have occurred within the last 12 months is how the people who have admitted to doing these things, who don't deny them, have nevertheless tried to come back into public life, have tried to somehow reduce the impact of what they've done and reduce the magnitude of what they've done. So, and
Well, I mean, I guess there are degrees of terrible things, but I would say drugging and having sex with a 16-year-old while she's unconscious is pretty terrible.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it's an incredible violation. I can't imagine anything more gross, and it's also an act of violence, of course, against someone.
But, of course, also, we'll never know if it actually happened.
That's absolutely correct. But I've tried to present, you know, the broadest, the fair, to be fair-minded in all of this. And I hope that readers will understand that. I'm not trying to deny that it occurred. I would never want to do that. And I think the book is actually a very positive portrayal of Evelyn Nesbit. I think what it tries to do is show her as a person, as someone who is very, is really actually much more a victim than anything else. Because whatever interpretation you put on the events, it's very clear that she was being pressured all the time by all these men in her life. I mean, the 47-year-old Stanford White, the Harry Thor who has the millions of dollars, the lawyers who are saying this, that, and the other to her. And she is very, very young, and I think that's the thing that's been missed from previous accounts is her youth. And you get that from some of the photographs that she's posing. The other thing I try to do is, in a sense, redeem her reputation, because her reputation has been as that someone, the counterpart to the idea that this was a seduction is that somehow it was then consensual and somehow she contributed to it. And what I've tried to do is say, no, no, no. Throughout my account, she's someone who is clearly a victim. She's 16 years old. She's a young girl when this rape occurs. And even when she goes into the courtroom, she's only 21, all right? And so you've got to think of her in those ways. She's certainly not a seductress when she's 16-year-old. That's absolutely ridiculous.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and my guest this week is Simon Botts. He's the author of The Girl on the Velvet Swing, Sex, Murder, and Madness at the Dawn of the 20th Century. Well, Simon Botts, would you say that Evelyn Nesbit was at the very least a victim of bad parenting?
Yes, but that's very ambiguous, because one of the criticisms of Evelyn's mother, Evelyn and her mother Florence came to New York by way of Philadelphia, from Pittsburgh to first Philadelphia, then to New York, and Evelyn's career as a showgirl, as a chorus girl, was supporting the family. She had a younger brother as well, and people criticized Evelyn's mother. Why wasn't she looking after her child? Why wasn't she more careful, more of a guardian? But you could say that Florence Nesbit, the mother, had no education to speak of. She was gullible. She was taken in by people who are much more clever and sharp than she was. The other thing that I should mention is that, in fact, there are other accounts. It's obviously not easy to get descriptions of this very private behavior, but there are a couple of other accounts, a couple of other autobiographies that describe Stanford White as someone very interested in young girls, who would have them pose naked, that sort of thing, or have photographers take pictures of the girls, and these pictures would be circulated among the friends. So there's certainly circumstantial evidence which points to White as a predator.
The movie that we've been talking about that people might want to find and watch again, The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing, Ray Milland, who plays Stanford White, he's got like this little playhouse with this red velvet swing. So did he really have that?
Yes, he did. Well, there was a swing that's described by Evelyn, and this was on the fourth floor of the townhouse on 24th Street. And so Stanford White invited Evelyn and a friend to lunch. White had a friend with him, and the first chapter of the book is how they spent the afternoon playing on this swing, which had a velvet seat and had velvet cords coming down from the ceiling. And so that is very accurate, and that's where the title comes from. The other thing that happens in the film is that there's a scene which is, again, from real life, and that is when, in 1895, so this is 6 years before the rape, White and a lot of friends held a big, big dinner, and the centerpiece of the dinner was when the waiters brought in this enormous pie, six waiters carrying this enormous pie. They put it on the table, and a young girl who's virtually naked steps out of the pie. And this was kind of a scandal in 1895. It was hushed up. but there is an account in the New York World, and the World took up this case and publicized it because the young girl, who is called Susie Johnson, disappeared about a few months later. She just vanished, and no one could find out what happened to her, and her parents were very distraught. And there was a big, big thing by the World that why are these wealthy men corrupting these young girls? And the young girls are working class girls from the tenements, and here are these famous men with lots of money doing these bad things, having these parties with these young girls. But that was very much hushed up. But then it all comes out in 1906 when White is killed.
Well, in both of your books, I think they're both fantastic books. For the Thrill of It, Leopold Loeb and the Murder That Shocked Chicago, and The Girl on the Velvet Swing, Sex, Murder, and Madness at the Dawn of the 20th Century. They're both incredibly detailed. You tell us what people were wearing, how their expressions changed. How are you able to reconstruct the histories that happened so long ago in such a vivid form?
It's really very nice of you to say that, and I'm very appreciative when people notice that, because some people don't notice that. And the answer is actually in the Leopold and Loeb case, the answer was in the transcripts of the legal hearings. And this was an extraordinary record. I mean, you're talking like 3,000 pages. So there's 3,000 pages of the legal hearing that they had in 1924. Then there's also the psychiatric reports that are extensive. I mean, they're hundreds of pages. And the detail that's contained in that documentation, plus the newspaper accounts, that's where all that detail comes from. And it's similar with the Sanford Way case, because there's very little transcripts left of the trials. That hasn't survived. But what happened was that these 14 daily newspapers are just, the coverage is so extraordinary. It's like each newspaper would have the whole page, three pages of the whole newspaper in very, very small type, very small font on this case. And they all sent their reporters out to interview every single person they could possibly find. And I just spent a huge amount of time, many years, collecting all these newspaper articles from 8 of these newspapers. I couldn't do all 14 because, you know, it takes a lifetime to do this work. And the consequence is that you just accumulate this incredible amount of detail. One of the most difficult things, I think, for a writer is to try and then figure out what kind of detail is really insignificant and what detail is significant. And that's something that you only get with this perspective of time, because you can't really fit everything else in. It's impossible to put all the detail in, but it's very important to be able to tell a story. And so that's basically the answer to your question. It's this very, very detailed research that enables you to construct a very detailed picture of the events. And I'm fortunate because, you know, I'm employed as a professor, and so I have the time, and now I have a research assistant who can also help me with this work. It's very laborious because you have to go through the microfilm reels. I had one person said to me, oh, your research must be quite easy now because it's all on the internet. But that's not the case at all, because these newspapers are not on the internet. And so you have to go to the microfilm reel, and you have to go to the machine and make copies, and that's very time-consuming business. But the rewards are great because, as you say, you know, you can get a very detailed picture of what happened.
Where do you find these? At the New York Public Library or what?
Yes, they're at the New York Public Library. I was also able to use the microfilm reels at Columbia. They have the major newspapers, the New York World, the New York Herald, the New York Tribune. And then the New York Public Library has all those newspapers, but they have more obscure ones, such as the New York American. There's also the Morning Telegram, the Evening Telegraph. These are newspapers that nobody remembers, that were like big, big enterprises in their days. But, I mean, even historians of New York are not familiar with the Morning Telegram. I mean, that's just so obscure. But that newspaper had great accounts, you know, of the conversation and the dialogue. And one question that people have raised is, well, can you trust these newspapers, right? Because they want to sell copies, so they want to make their accounts as sensational as possible. The way I found that problem could be overcome is if you're going through 8 different newspapers and you begin to find that the accounts are similar, then you know that they must be fairly accurate. Because if the newspapers are making stuff up, then you're not going to have corroboration in other newspapers of these events that occur. So
do you, are you like a reporter that says, I must find at least 2 or 3 accounts of this thing before I consider that it happened?
Well, I remember when I was working on Leopold and Loeb, and I was going through the Chicago Daily Tribune, and I started out, because that was really the book where I first began to do this kind of detailed research, and I started out by thinking, I won't have to go through any other newspapers. And then somehow, I don't know how it was, but I looked at a different newspaper, maybe it was the Chicago Daily News, and I suddenly realized that this adds a kind of depth, you know, that newspapers don't all read exactly the same. Some focus on different aspects. Some have reporters who are sharper or more inquisitive. And so that made me realize that the best account I could write would be coming from many newspapers. And so in Chicago, I managed to do all 6. And in New York, I did 8 of the 14. So,
is there another crime that you're going to turn your attention on now?
Yeah, I'm looking, because I'm in New York, of course, and because New York is such an important city, I'm looking at different crimes in New York. I'm not sure, you know, the great advantage of doing a crime is that you have a wonderful record, which is the trial, you know, because when the trial happens, everything comes out, or you hope it does, at least. And I haven't really decided on the next project, because this previous book has just appeared, and I'm still looking around, but there are a ton of cases out there, and I'm sure that I'll find something interesting and exciting to work on.
And the early 20th century is still your focus?
Yes, and there's a very good reason for that as well, because all these newspapers in whatever American city, every major American city had many newspapers, but that all came to a crushing halt in 1929, the Great Depression. And suddenly these newspapers, you had the radio coming in 1920s, so that was an alternative source of news. But in the 1929 Depression really caused a lot of these newspapers to fold, and what they did was merge together. But that kind of process then accelerated down the 20th century, but it was 1929. And I think there's a big difference. Before 1929, the newspapers could afford to send out dozens of reporters. After 1929, it's very obvious that they can't do that anymore. And so the accounts, so it's not only that there are fewer newspapers, but also that the coverage is very sharply reduced. And you don't, after 1929, for example, whatever the crime is, you don't get this verbatim testimony. I mean, with the Harry Thor case, there's page after page after page of verbatim testimony. And the newspapers could presumably afford to do that because they had the resources and they could, and also they had all this other coverage, but they couldn't do that after 1929. So being able to get at that kind of detail disappears if you don't have the sources and you don't have the newspapers after 1929.
Well, both of these books are fantastic, and I want to mention the titles of both for my listeners. The first one, For the Thrill of It, Leopold, Loeb, and the Murder That Shocked Chicago. It's the definitive work on the Leopold and Loeb case. And the new book that we've been discussing today, The Girl on the Velvet Swing, Sex, Murder, and Madness at the Dawn of the 20th Century. Simon Botts, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf and talking about your work.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to talk about the book and also to be back on your show again. And I'm hoping that when the next book comes out, I'll be invited back as a guest. It'd be an honor and a pleasure to talk again.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.